Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
Radha Iyengar.
And we have with us a very special guest this week. Rebecca Listener is joining us to fill the fabulous shoes of Aaron Simpson, who is in Kansas, in Iowa, LA. I can't remember. She's somewhere in the middle of the country or on the other side of the country.
In a very Aaron fashion, we did get a detailed itinerary, and to this moment, I cannot in any way recall any of the information on it.
So. Not in any way. Sorry, Aaron. So we are still distributed ops in the D.C., California, and New York areas, but couldn't quite nail down Aaron enough to actually get her on Skype for an hour or so. So Aaron, if we screw it up, it's all your fault. So we have a fabulous agenda to talk through this week with all of our favorite best hits from Iran to Korea to the VA to sexual assaults and Madison, Dunford, and Pompeo, God knows what else. But we'll start off with our introductory questions for Rebecca. Radha, do you want to kick those off?
Rebecca, let's start with, what is your entrance music?
Great. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I am thrilled to be here on Bombshell and could never presume to fill Aaron's shoes, but I'm happy to be taking her place for the day. So with regards to entrance music, this one's actually difficult. In some ways, I have two answers. So my first answer was California Love by Tupac.
That's
many
amazing.
People assume that I am a native New Yorker or from the East Coast, but in fact, I'm born and raised in Oakland, California. So I think my life anthem entrance music would definitely have to be California Love. But when thinking about the answer to this question in a more Bombshell specific context, I recalled that I've had very specific fantasies about entering all male conferences with Beyonce's Run the World Girls playing in the background. And so I thought I would be remiss in not mentioning that, at least as my mantle entrance music.
Oh my gosh.
How good
also,
would that
instead
be?
Of one of those taboo buzzers, like when men interrupt you, if you could just like hit a button and that song would just play just a couple bars, I feel like it would really help.
On International Women's Day, I had my annual office toast that I do for women at my organization. And this year we had men come in and I had Beyonce, Who Runs the World, blasting on my phone. And all the men are like, what in the hell is going on here? Why did you invite us? Like, we're terrified. Like, no, please join. Please join us in a toast.
Please join in your subservient role to our celebration as we run things. Just kidding, men.
Before we ask this next question, I should note I'm watching Rebecca over Skype, and she has on her wall a beautiful picture of Gwyneth Paltrow. So even as she answers this question, please know that she does have some pop culture chops. Rebecca, what is your most quoted movie line?
So I'm not much of a movie quoter. I don't have a whole lot to give you here. I will admit that there was a time when I had a deep bench of Zoolander and Romy and Michelle's high school reunion movie quotes that seemed really relevant to life. But at this point, I don't have a great deal. What I do have is this amazing Gwyneth Paltrow glitter art hanging behind me in my apartment, which was actually a gift from one of my students at Georgetown back in the day. And is by far the best bribe I ever got from someone who was trying to get me to give them a passing grade. And I continue to treasure it, even as I've lost touch with the student who made it.
I feel like you need to restart. You need to restart your Zoolander quotes. I feel like Zoolander can explain so much of foreign policy. And in fact, I tried to work a Zoolander quote into every Atlantic piece I've ever written. So editors, if you've noticed this, then I'm happy, because this is my lifelong goal to achieve Zoolander and the breakup as how they explain foreign policy overall.
I think this is the part where I'm supposed to say, cool story, Hansel.
Yep, exactly. What book does everyone else love but you can't stand?
So I have never read any of the Harry Potter books. I've never seen the movie.
Wow.
I've never been to the Broadway show. I assume that I won't like them, which is why I haven't even bothered to read them, and didn't even as a child. But I recognize that that sets me apart from basically the whole rest of the world population.
Even I have read the Harry Potter books.
Yeah. If you ever have I reread the entire series immediately after the 2016 election, and it was a balm for the soul. So if you ever have a moment like that, which I hope you never do ever again, it could be a good opportunity to pick those up.
Okay. Good to know.
What is your favorite bar in the world?
So this is not a bar per se, but Scribe Winery in Sonoma is by far the best place where I have ever had a drink. It's this wonderful hipster winery where they have picnic tables overlooking vineyards and this old sort of rundown hacienda where you can get some food and drinks. And it is just one of the most pleasant places you could possibly open a bottle of wine and have a little picnic and learn a bit about what they're up to. And I would really strongly recommend it to anyone who is in Northern California.
I feel like we're getting a lot of Northern California recommendations for potential places where Bombshell could have a field trip. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I mean, Corey, if you're listening, I know you're in London now, but I feel like maybe we need to do a field trip to your dusty little cow town out in Sonoma. And okay, Radha, last question goes to you.
Rebecca, what is the best use of statistics or data you have ever seen?
So this one's really hard. As a political scientist, I consume a lot of data and statistics. It's really hard to choose a favorite. So I'm going with recency. This is one that I heard just last week from Diana Mutz, who's a brilliant political scientist at Penn. And she presented this really interesting paper at a workshop I attended that looked at the impact of in-group favoritism on trade preferences. And basically what she found was that Americans have an extremely strong preference for trade policies that create and preserve American jobs specifically, and are pretty much entirely indifferent to the positive overall impacts of international trade. And so in her survey experiment, she found that even in a case where the net benefits of trade are huge, and only one American loses their job, while 1,000 people in a trading partner country gain jobs, even so, only 22% of Americans will favor such a policy and 78% will oppose. So I think it's just fascinating. She is doing all this interesting research basically about how in these trade debates we're having in the United States, elite views are so far apart from popular preferences when it comes to international economics.
That'll be a handy statistic when we talk about the Macron-Merkel visits in a bit.
Exactly.
I realized at the beginning of our episode, we neglected to do two things. First, we didn't actually introduce Rebecca and her. I think mostly because I'm intimidated. She has like 39 titles that I will allow her to go through. And nor did we talk about what we are drinking. And that's also because I'm embarrassed because I'm drinking a really crappy Pinot Noir that I just found downstairs somewhere. So, Rebecca, can you tell our listeners who are you exactly? Where do you come from?
Who am I? Well, I am currently a research fellow at the University of Pennsylvania's Global Policy Research Center called Perry World House.
Okay, that was only one title. So I get that was slightly less intimidating. Perry World House is a fabulous place with our great friend Mike Horowitz and many others. People should visit and listen to their podcast, which is great.
Yes.
Brado, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a slightly random rosé that I picked up at a winery that we literally drove by on the way back from somewhere called Bonnie Doon Winery. It's actually quite delightful.
That's very
but
nice.
It's sunny and warm here, so I feel like it's a rosé kind of day.
And Rebecca is drinking water. So it's an exciting beverage sort of week here on Bombshell. However, it was a very exciting week in terms of major moments in foreign policy. If people didn't were somehow asleep over the last week or so and didn't catch the thousands and thousands of videos of the amazing handshake that took place on the North Korean-South Korean border. We brought Rebecca on to cover the whole show, but we really would like to get her thoughts on this historic moment in North Korea where the North Korean and South Korean leaders met in South Korea for the first time since, the early 1950s. Give us the right. How did we get to this moment? And should we be extremely hopeful about what it says about the future of peace on the Korean Peninsula? Or it was just largely symbolic and we shouldn't really care?
Well, to start with your second question first, I think we could be I think we ought to be skeptical and at best cautiously optimistic about the progress that we might see going forward. To provide a little bit more context, so there have been just an incredible flurry of events over the past few weeks. It can be a bit hard to keep up. But exactly as Lauren said, on Friday, we saw Kim Jong-un walk across the DMZ and into South Korea, which is actually the first time a North Korean leader has ever set foot in the South. And of course, there he met with the South Korean president. They seemed to have a pretty cordial and reasonably productive day of negotiations, at the end of which they released a joint statement. And that statement had sort of two key points. So the first was a commitment to the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And a second was a commitment to try to end the Korean War and establish what they called a peace regime on the peninsula by the end of the year. It also made some more minor commitments to opening liaison offices on both sides of the DMZ and allowing for some inter-Korean family reunifications. So there's no question that this is sort of a stunning development and that the joint statement that they agreed upon is strikingly ambitious in what it seeks to accomplish. I think there still is a great deal of details that remain to be worked out for any of this to be realized in any concrete form. And I think that it is far more likely and not that as those details are actually worked out, both sort of between the Koreas and also in preparation for the Kim-Trump summit that's coming in the next month or two, the whole thing could very well fall apart or at least fail to yield the gains that the more optimistic folks hope.
And Rebecca, how did we get here? Do we have some understanding of what sort of prompted this? I know that Trump administration in particular has been had a very sort of different posture than past administrations on this. So how should we think about this in the context of sort of recent events, both in the U.S. and internationally?
And let me add on one amendment to that question is our own dear leader wants to take credit, I think, for a lot of what happened in on the Korean Peninsula this week. So I guess my question is related to that would be, who should be able to claim credit here? Who kind of was the most ambitious or gave the most in terms of wanting to be able to make this happen, this historic moment happen?
Right. I mean, I've seen that there's sort of been this guerrilla social media campaign where people are starting to suggest that Trump and Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un and Moon should all be, you know, jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize or something like that. But I think we're still very far from being anywhere near that point. Part of how we might explain the effectiveness or apparent effectiveness in reaching this point in terms of negotiation sort of depends on what you think Kim Jong-un is actually after and what he might be responding to. I think, you know, the Trump version of this is basically that this so-called maximum pressure campaign has worked, right? That it was the combination of increasingly aggressive UN sanctions, which of course built on progress that goes back to earlier administrations and especially the Obama administration, that it was pressure from China, which of course Trump has been working really hard to garner. And also, above all, the credible threat of war that together compelled North Korea to back down. I don't think that Trump himself deserves pure credit from that. I think we're seeing a confluence of international events here. But you can't deny the fact that, you know, there are a lot of us who take very seriously the idea that, you know, Trump was intending to, or at least was considering the possibility of launching a war against North Korea. That could still happen. But I think the prospect of that has perhaps forced Kim Jong-un to at least reevaluate the stance that he had been taking previously. Because, you have to remember that prior to this sort of pause in missile testing and nuclear testing, Kim Jong-un had pursued both at an unprecedented tempo. So at the very least, we're seeing Kim Jong-un responding differently to the set of incentives he faces. Of course, whether this will ultimately result in a breakthrough, it's far too soon to say.
So one of the other hot takes that has gone around in the last week is that this is, as we did discuss before, largely symbolic and mostly a move by Kim Jong-un to be seen as a big boy or an adult at the adults' table in international affairs these days. And it's been remarkable to me to watch the posture that we went from President Trump and he effectively trading insults over Twitter and other forms, other mediums, to now where it seems as though we are in this crazy historic moment where the entire tenor has changed. It's Kim Jong-un, if we should all remember, has in the last several years been accused of killing his uncle and other family members, of running
in horrific ways.
In horrific ways, and number of Americans have died under bizarre circumstances when they were imprisoned there, running prison camps. Like, this is not a guy who you necessarily would have thought of should be this like nice cuddly fellow to come over and make a peace deal. But his posture in the last several weeks has been quite different. What's to make of this change in public posture for Kim Jong-un over the last, over the last several weeks, and how should we expect that to go forward over the next few months as he deals with President Trump?
So I think it remains to be seen how big of a change this actually is. What we've seen thus far, exactly as you said, Lauren, is really a change in tone, right? Ever since his New Year's speech back in January, there's been this real softening, especially from the type of approach that we saw characterizing the last year or two. But what has he actually given up at this point? Well, so just recently he announced that he would close down his nuclear test site in May. And then he even agreed to the possibility or proposed the possibility that South Korean and American journalists and experts could come as witnesses to see as this nuclear test site was basically dismantled. But there are real questions about whether that is a truly costly concession. There was a really interesting report in the Wall Street Journal last week about Chinese seismologists who have been monitoring activity at this nuclear test site, which is only 50 miles from the Chinese border. And basically what they found is that much of the test site has already collapsed internally, the tunnel network where the nuclear testing actually happens, and that the site itself is more or less useless, or at least that further testing could cause a major environmental catastrophe. What is more, thinking about the possible cost of fixing the test site, I mean, it could very well bankrupt the North Korean economy, and it's not clear they can even afford to repair it. And so on the one hand, that seems to be a mark of real progress and is being heralded as such. But then on the other hand, you have to ask, you know, how costly is that concession really for North Korea? So what we've seen so far is a lot of, you know, progress in terms of rhetoric, but it's not clear what Kim is actually going to be willing to give up. At the same time, exactly as you said, Lauren, he's already gained a lot, right? He's become sort of the hot international leader that everyone's looking to meet with. He's gained a lot of validation. There's sort of already the hint of some concessions from the South Korean side. So if I were Kim, I would be looking to lock down as many concrete concessions as possible while deferring for as long as possible any meaningful concessions on his own part, especially as it relates to his nuclear program.
And so let me sort of tie this into another thing that's been going on internationally, which is sort of continued or renewed discussions on the Iran deal. And we'll come to that in some more detail. But, you know, you mentioned some aspects, right, external, like what are the real concessions? Who's going to actually validate that these things have actually happened? So what sorts of things should we look for, and maybe from some lessons from the Iran deal and more broadly, in terms of meaningful concessions from Kim? And how should we think about really any of these agreements in a world in which it looks like the Iran deal might not survive sort of contact?
Absolutely. So just to put it in a broader perspective, I would say that there's a credible commitment problem on both sides, right? Both for the United States and sort of the bloc that we represent, and from the North Koreans. So from the US perspective, looking at North Korea, the crux of the question is what kind of inspections and verification regime will the North Koreans agree to that can actually verify that the North has given up its nuclear program, including its existing nuclear weapons, its plutonium processing capabilities, and its uranium enrichment capabilities. And this is particularly challenging in light of the fact that North Korea has broken myriad denuclearization commitments before, right? They previously agreed to denuclearization in 1992, in 1994, in 2005, in 2012. None of those have stuck. And in fact, some of them have broken down precisely over disagreements over verification and inspections protocols. So that remains a major unresolved question. And I think, you know, if we start to see progress there, that could be a much more promising sign. But it remains totally unclear how the Trump administration is thinking about going about that, and whether Pyongyang would ever accept what the terms of such a deal might be. On the other hand, from the North Korean perspective, it's hard to feel that the U.S. can credibly commit to providing any security guarantee. So Kim Jong-un just today, for the first time, said that he would consider actually giving up his nuclear weapons in exchange for a commitment from the United States not to ever invade the country and to basically, you know, extend some kind of security guarantee to the North. But how can the U.S. sort of credibly commit to avoiding any sort of future invasion, regime change, or other types of unacceptable coercion that it might impose upon the North? And here, the U.S. also has a pretty problematic record, right? Because the U.S. has reneged on commitments like the one that Kim is apparently asking for before. In fact, John Bolton is going around explicitly using the Libya analogy. But as we all know, giving up the WMD program in Libya did not end up so well for Gaddafi. So how can Kim be assured that he's not going to suffer a similar fate? And exactly to Rada's point, I mean, we see with the Iran deal that the U.S. had, you know, committed to, it wasn't a treaty, but it was, you know, a formal agreement that had extremely stringent inspections and verification protocols, which the Iranians sort of begrudgingly but ultimately agreed to. And now increasingly, it looks like the U.S. is going to walk away from that deal. So by a similar token, you know, why would the North Koreans sort of expect that any guarantee it could get from the United States, especially from the Trump administration, would be valid? So I think those are both kind of major outstanding questions. And should we see any progress on each, I would be optimistic. But to me, they both seem fairly intractable.
So using that as a chance to switch over to keeping up foreign relations, I am struck in thinking through the number of truly complex issues that the Trump administration is going to have to deal with in their Korea summit. Thinking back to the Obama administration's preparations for the Iran negotiations, which all three of us were in some ways involved in, and just the level of detail that not only the staff was able to address, but also at the principal's level, the deputy's level, and even the president himself had just completely taken on board all of the multiple complex issues, that even down to like a technical perspective. Like Ernie Moniz was vital to this negotiation, but the president himself was able to go, President Obama himself was able to go down into nitty-gritty levels of detail. In this administration, we're seeing a moment where, you know, Mike Pompeo was just confirmed. John Bolton just recently started as national security advisor. And I think it is charitable to say that President Trump does not have the greatest command of detail of international negotiations. And in the coming week, we're coming up to another, or coming week and a half, I suppose, coming up to another milestone in the Iran deal, where we just had both Macron and Merkel come in to try to convince President Trump to be able to stay as a party to this. So either Rada or Rebecca, can you kind of talk through, like, what's this next milestone, and what's the decision process that the Trump administration is going through?
So May 12th is the next deadline, at which point President Trump is going to have to decide whether he's going to continue to waive sanctions as part of the Iran deal. Back when he did so last time, issued the last waiver, he basically said that he was going to kick it over to the Europeans, potentially in concert with Congress, and it was up to them to fix the deal. If they didn't, then he was going to walk away. And so that set off what has basically been a frenzied 90-day process by which our European partners in the deal have been working seemingly with Brian Hook at the State Department, who is one of the few people who seems to have stayed on after Tillerson's departure from his core team, to try to craft some kind of solution that will at least satisfy Trump's demands. So now, as we come up on this May 12th deadline, there are basically a few options, a few directions that Trump might go. I think the first is that Trump might see whatever progress has been made by the Europeans and basically call it a win or back down, that he'll, in effect, allow the Iran nuclear deal to continue on and potentially initiate some kind of parallel process that seeks to supplement it in some way, but will allow the sort of core bargain to continue. Second, I think we could see him start a process of reimposing sanctions as a means to ratchet up pressure while talks are still ongoing. So not sort of definitively say we're done with the JCPOA, but rather say, well, we're planning to walk away from it, sort of in the way that he's threatened tariffs, but not actually imposed tariffs in a bunch of cases, and try to use that to leverage additional pressure, both with the Europeans and with the Iranians, to try to get to some new agreement. And third, I think we could just see him terminate U.S. participation entirely. We know that the president has sort of only agreed to allow the deal to live in previous at previous deadlines, sort of kicking and screaming. The national security team has changed since the last time he did this in January. Pompeo, when he was in the Middle East just a few days after confirmation, was speaking very disparagingly of the deal. We know that John Bolton thinks it's a bad deal. And so a lot of the people who had been sort of in Trump's ear really trying to advocate for the deal are no longer there. And so I think that does sort of increase the likelihood that we could see that termination where we hadn't seen it before.
And let me add a couple other bits of color. One, keep in mind that what happens when the U.S. withdraws from the deal is that the U.S. can impose sanctions unilaterally again, but the bite of the sanctions that sort of brought, at least so the theory goes, that brought Iran to the table was a sort of unified, very aggressive set of sanctions that covered not just the U.S. and not just Europe, but actually Russia, right? And so we had a broad scale economic pressure on Iran, with Iran having strong desire to become part of that world system that helped drive this. It's not clear that that type of pressure would exist. And it's not clear to me what the incentive for Iran to agree to other things, like in particular control of its ballistic missile program, which was notably omitted from the original deal and obviously has been the source of some serious contention from Iranian action post the deal. But the second bit is that we're also about to establish these steel tariffs that the U.S. has currently created an exemption for Europe for, that would bite in particular Germany, but the EU broadly pretty hard. Germany's, I think, the fifth largest producer of steel. So, you know, we're kind of coming at this in a world in which the U.S. could withdraw unilaterally. The unilateral withdrawal is something that the Europeans are planning for. It's not clear what the consequences to Iran are from a unilateral U.S. withdrawal. And it's not clear entirely what the benefits to the Europeans are in a world in which Trump is about to impose tariffs. And frankly, Merkel had some pretty strong words about the EU being willing to, you know, hit back if there are targeted tariffs at them. So this sort of confluence of America first policies, which Trump is kind of been chomping at the bit to employ and that are all kind of coming to a head here, I think really pits our traditional alliances and cooperation with Europeans with quote unquote U.S. economic self-interest.
And that's a really interesting segue into the visits that we had this week from Macron and Merkel, where we had President Trump's first state visit and state dinner with President Macron. The two presidents apparently plant a tree on the White House lawn that I am sad it is closed, has recently been displaced and I guess put into quarantine. Sort of unclear what happened there. There was fabulous fashion that we could spend lots of time on, but clearly one of the key components of this visit was Macron and Merkel had must have heavily coordinated ahead of time. It's a little bizarre from any number of reasons to have a major state visit by one senior European official followed, you know, just a few days later by another senior European officials. They clearly thought about this ahead of time and wanted to do a 1-2 punch on both the Iran deal as well as these tariffs that Radha just mentioned. And while I think President Trump had a gorgeous little bromance with Macron, apparently there's a lot of appetite for seeing heterosexual men be physically affectionate with one another on social media. In terms of actual policy agreement, we didn't get a lot. We didn't get a warm and fuzzy, I would say, from what we came away with. Macron followed up with a speech to Congress that basically did not use the president's name, but criticized everything about his foreign policy and domestic policy. And neither really shared anything in terms of hope for the Iran deal or hope for the tariffs discussion that it came out later. Did either of you have a different impression or want to add to that?
Well, I want to add two points of clarification. One, just to be clear, it wasn't just a bromance. Trump gave two kisses to Merkel, having picked up apparently the habit from the French.
Not okay, but the Germans don't do that.
When greeted? I know.
But the Germans don't do that. It's very awkward.
And there were handshakes. Handshakes were had. So the lack of handshake heard around the world sort of was remedied. But, you know, I agree. I think the visits were clearly coordinated. I don't completely understand or know how to interpret, and will be interested to hear, kind of see what happens going forward. The real disconnect between what seemed to be a very collegial, hugging it out meeting between Macron and Trump when at the White House, and then a very stern talking to externally when Macron went and addressed Congress. But I think we heard pretty clearly from Merkel where they're at, which is, we're willing to talk basically alongside the margins of the Iran deal if you guys like get it together and stay in, like, and if you tariff us, we're going to tariff you back and stop talking to us about, roughly, she didn't say this, but I think the general gist is, stop talking to us about European defense spending. Not going to happen, my friend. So I think that's where we are.
By the way, European defense spending, can we just all agree as just like national security people that using percentage of GDP as any sort of goal for defense spending is remarkably stupid, and we should just stop. Can we just stop?
Well, also, there's a sense that the 2% threshold is somehow this immutable element of the North Atlantic Treaty or something like that, whereas, in fact, it was only agreed upon at the Wales Summit in 2014.
Right.
It's not exactly the pillar of the NATO alliance.
Yes, but I will say this. I don't think it's crazy to suggest that there should be greater European investment in military spending, but I think that there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what GDP captures and how it should be, or shouldn't, more precisely, should not be relevant for your military spending and production, that underlies this entire conversation. So I myself would vote for your let's stop linking GDP to military spending as our criteria for how well you're doing in either direction. But I don't think those were the only two world leaders who met that week. This week
they were not. We had President Xi and our good friend from India. Oh my God, I've lost his title. President Modi? Prime Minister? Modi. Prime Minister Modi met this week. And did they have a massive fisticuffs, as we have seen from prior Chinese-Indian engagements in the last year? Or was it pleasant?
It was quite pleasant. I was delighted to have this back on the agenda because I was thinking, we haven't had a chance to revisit our friends and their border skirmishes with fisticuffs and dance fighting, which occurred, as many may recall, earlier this year. But actually, in more seriousness, you know, this was a start of a relatively productive conversation between leaders in India and China. Some of it was discussion on border issues. Some of it was discussion on sort of the broader sort of fraught relationship between the two countries, both in economic and political terms. I think the positive from this is it looks like there was a reset, which has really ratcheted down the tensions. I think they've committed to special representatives that are going to help try to hash through some of the territorial issues, which sort of kicks the can down the road on complicated things like Tibet, but certainly establishes a more formal pathway to resolve things that feels a lot more calm than having troops randomly engage with each other at various points along the border. But, you know, it's not entirely clear where we're going to end up with this post the Indian elections, which are coming up. So I think, you know, on the one hand, it's positive to see this relationship emerging, frankly, independent of U.S. engagement with both countries. Both countries are sort of feeling some pressure from the economic saber rattling right now, with not specific responses from the Trump administration's sort of protectionist economic policy, but certainly both would face brunt from it. So I think it's kind of a remains to be seen, but potentially positive. Rebecca, did you have other thoughts?
So I would agree with that. And I would just sort of add sort of two outstanding sort of strategic questions that I think are raised by this. I mean, one is, it was interesting that in their joint statement, the Chinese and Indian leaders sort of identified together as the world's largest developing countries and emerging markets, and they even called themselves the backbone of the world's multipolarization and economic globalization. And especially, I found the use of the word multipolarization really interesting, because it seems to be sort of holding themselves out as this, not a unified bloc, but both as sort of important poles that exist apart from the United States and stand to exert sort of a lot more influence on global affairs. And in some cases, as developing countries and emerging markets have congruent interests with each other. On the other hand, though, it's interesting to look at this summit in the context of what the Trump administration has sort of called its free and open Indo-Pacific strategy or concept. And that relies very much on this idea of enlisting India as a balance to China in the region. And so from China's perspective, I would say that it's very much sort of in their interest to try to maintain decent relations with India so that India doesn't sort of get on board with this sort of Indo-Pacific, you know, sort of quasi-containment concept. And so to the extent that this cooperation can sort of continue or in the reset can kind of, you know, bear fruit in some more meaningful ways, I think that's on balance a win to China.
All right, so moving on to White House mayhem. It is hearing season over on the Hill, where the Defense Department is going over to defend their budget and talk about all of their posture hearings in what seems to be dozens and dozens of visits over to Capitol Hill. This week, we had Secretary Mattis and General Dunford before the SASC, as well as also I want to note that they were, I believe they were testifying before the HACD, but we wouldn't know much about it because that hearing was closed. They decided to have that only in a classified setting, which is fairly unprecedented. Something hasn't happened in a long time. But a few points of news were made during the SASC hearing where they covered, you know, kind of an around the world, what's going on with a lot of stuff. So Radha, what were the big points that came out of that discussion?
So I think there were three big points and then two more minor but important issues that I want to talk about. So the first, I think there was an extended discussion on how we think about and whether we should think about loosening up our restrictions on military sales and military military engagements or military support to countries that buy arms from Russia. And so this, Mattis and Dunford were making the case that this is overly hampering our ability to sort of build up strategic relationships. Obviously, this comes in the context of broader discussions on how we view our relationship to and relationship against Russia and its current activities or past activities. The second big issue related to defense of the Iran deal, which Mattis seemed to maintain the old party line and not the new party line. So I'm not sure if Bolton or the NSC staff cleared on that testimony, and I have some questions. And the third was Syria and sort of a discussion of the Syrian airstrikes and our broader Syria, quote unquote, strategy or lack thereof. There were two other personnel issues that I myself was paying attention to. One was a back and forth with Senator Gillibrand on transgender issues and transgender numbers. Mattis did seem to be prepped on it and had a number of sort of pretty full-throated responses to why this was important for readiness, though when pressed could not remember the names of the medical professionals they consulted with to make these decisions. And the second was sexual assault in the military, which came up in the hearing and Mattis had pretty strong words about as a cancer among our ranks. He has recently released a memo reminding folks that, yes, sexual assault is still a thing, and yes, we do want to still reduce it. And I think we could have an entire This Is Still a Thing segment on this. Maybe we will at some further date. But for the time being, suffice to say, sexual assault numbers have continued to go up, partly due to reporting. But it remains to be seen sort of how that is linked up with overall efforts to reduce the overall incidence in sexual assault in the military. That's my recap in a moment, but happy to dig into any of these.
Well, I think the one other headline that came out of it was, you know, I think both Mattis and Dunford use this as an opportunity to continue their advocacy, of course, for the defense budget. And so some people reported coming out that, you know, one of the things Mattis said was that, you know, of course, the FY19 defense budget is the first one that reflects the national defense strategy that he oversaw and released recently. And he made the case in this hearing that that strategy would not be sustainable if budget caps return after 2 years as they're currently slated to per the current budget deal. And so it's just sort of a sort of continued return to the persistent theme of the need for sort of long-term predictability in the defense budget and the permanent removal of budget caps.
A theme that the OMB director, Mick Mulvaney, has not been terribly helpful to them on, nor has Mick Mulvaney been helpful on a lot of other things, since apparently he only prioritizes meetings with lobbyists. So maybe if we had somebody do a campaign donation who is a lobbyist who has cared about long-term defense spending, we might have a bit more progress there. We had some drama in the personnel front this week, starting with we still don't have a Veterans Affairs Secretary, Ronnie Jackson, who I confess I will state up front has dispensed medical advice to me on a number of occasions. So when I worked at the White House, was originally nominated to be Veterans Affairs Secretary, withdrew his nomination after half a dozen semi-scandalous things were leaked about him that he has partially defended, partially not. That you know, that no real investigation has been done as to whether or not the allegations of handing out Percocet and OxyContin, driving drunk and being drunk while on duty, having a toxic work environment, and a number of other things were actually true, but were substantive enough that he withdrew. Radha, what is going on with the VA?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think I'm of two minds about this. On the one hand, you know, the nomination of the president's personal physician was always deeply, deeply problematic to run the, like, what, second, third largest department?
Second.
That also administers, like, I don't know, health and disability benefits to our veterans across the country, and who really struggled for management issues in the past few years, including really sort of in a very public way under the Obama administration. So it was really concerning and disappointing to see this appointment initially. One of the kind of ideas from the Trump administration coming in was the potential for some sort of business management leadership to come in with this. And there have over time been a number of thoughts on the value of having people who run large, for example, health insurance or other large companies coming in and managing this bureaucracy. And so none of that was realized. On the other hand, it's not really the other hand so much as just the other terrible part about this. Is it another hand? Anyway, that it revealed once again this sort of deeply concerning vetting and background checking process that appears to be going, or more accurately, not going on the Trump administration side. Though I will say, in defense of this administration, this is a doctor who has served in multiple past administrations and who has been repeatedly promoted through the military defense ranks. So it's not entirely clear why our background checks don't take these sort of factors into account, things that would frankly be disqualifying for a range of positions, not just Secretary of VA. But for the time being, I think we're, you know, in a situation where the VA really lacks strategic leadership and guidance, which might be okay in the near term, but is really not going to help address the myriad of problems, and certainly not address the reason why the last VA secretary said he left, which was a big push to privatize major parts of the VA. And so we'll see who the next nominee is, and we'll see what happens. But you know, that's the issue under debate right now.
Yeah, I confess one of the most disturbing points to me about this is, assuming there is any truth to these allegations, or even just that these allegations were made and have not appropriately been dealt with, is that what should be disqualifying for a VA secretary should also be disqualifying for a general officer, particularly one who is running the healthcare system for the president of the United States, as well as his staffers. So if is there an associated issue with the vetting and promotion of general officers that should be of concern to people as they are kind of, you know, tut-tutting over whether or not Dr. Jackson should have been promoted, or Admiral Jackson rather should have been promoted and nominated to be VA secretary. But I guess in the you know, stability for the Trump administration, good news, we had Mike Pompeo had his first day on the job over the last week, which just happened to be actually one of his first things that he did was go to NATO. It was after a kind of dicey confirmation process. But I think a lot of people at the State Department are fairly grateful to have somebody who's committed to rebuilding the department come on board. What are y'all's thoughts on Pompeo starting off over at Foggy Bottom?
So Pompeo certainly started off strong. Less than 12 hours after getting confirmed, he was already in Brussels, where we saw him take a different line from President Trump in the sense that he called NATO invaluable practically upon disembarking from the plane. But nonetheless, you know, to echo our earlier conversation, he previewed that the NATO summit this July, which Trump will attend, is going to maintain the president's focus on this 2% of GDP threshold. And so he's still kind of singing the same tune as the rest of the administration at the foreign ministerial this week. Then, of course, he headed straight to the Middle East, right, where he very quickly laid down a marker in Israel with a really strong alignment with Bibi Netanyahu, and then went on to voice really strong opposition to the Iran deal in Riyadh. And so I think more broadly, what this shows us is that Pompeo is going to be a much more muscular and assertive Secretary of State than Tillerson was, one who probably speaks with a far greater degree of authority on behalf of the president and the administration, in part because he is truthfully more aligned with Trump on some issues, precisely like the Iran deal, than the sort of first wave of national security team was. One thing that will be interesting to watch, I think, is the extent to which, as his star rises, he's going to be able to wrest the spotlight and wrest control from UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, from Jared Kushner, who it seems like we're hearing about less and less over in the White House. And even, I wonder, from Secretary Mattis over at the Pentagon, and whether, you know, really having an empowered Foggy Bottom is going to mean that the sort of monopoly over foreign policy that in many ways the Pentagon has enjoyed in the administration thus far is sort of finally broken.
And just actually very much consistent with that, I think two other things about Pompeo. One is, look, I sort of have a slightly, I don't know, blah view about this issue of alignment with Trump. I think having a Secretary of State who is at least appears to be consistent with the president is good. On the other hand, like, the president says a lot of things, and having sort of voices like Mattis and like what was former Secretary Tillerson sort of saying more reassuring things was helpful in at least creating some kind of ambiguity on how much things the president says will be executed. So we kind of lose that confusion, which maybe was actually helpful and will remains to be seen whether that is. But Pompeo does seem to have invested when he was at CIA in actually like running the department. He did use the department, he used the building, he had staff, he had career staff that worked with and for him and supported him. And I think to the extent that we care about the institution of the State Department, in addition to the diplomatic contributions of the State Department in this administration, I think that Pompeo is probably a step in the right direction there, that those foreign service officers and civil service officers and the whole community there at the State Department can get sort of a leadership that at least values what they're contributing and is figuring out how to use their that building for what it has been designed for. And so I hope to see sort of the career people there being used more and able to support the secretary and what he's doing more than was true under the Tillerson vote.
Well, and he's bringing back swagger.
Yeah, swagger. In a small but symbolic move in his trip to Brussels, he did apparently meet with the foreign service officers who were stationed there, as well as their families, something that Tillerson did not do on his first few trips. And it's one of those things that seems small, but it makes a big difference in terms of being able to demonstrate support for the people that work for him every day.
But I have a question, which is, if he's at state, who's at CIA?
That would be Gina Haspel, who is apparently, who has, as everyone remembers, is the first woman nominated to be the director of the CIA. She is the deputy director and the acting director. Her, as folks have probably been tracking, her confirmation has had a lot of speed bumps along the way, with her association with a number of kind of darker moments in CIA history associating with waterboarding and the destruction of evidence that we've talked about before. I believe has been postponed. Her hearing has been postponed until later this summer, as more of that information tends to come out. I think there's a lot of us who are wondering why they are shooting for her to be really confirmed at all, given that she effectively has much of the power of the CIA director and can be in that acting capacity for at least the time being, absent any other issues that come up in her nomination.
Yeah, and it's also slightly weird that given that the CIA, like, official Twitter was, like, tweeting about Gina Haspel, like, does she now approve the tweets about her? awesomeness? Or
that was definitely
creepy.
Is that
creepy. A third party?
The CIA tweeted editorials that were pro Haspel from like the Washington Examiner and other media outlets in a way that I think a lot of us probably found quite disturbing. It was probably not frankly reflective of like some massive change in CIA policy, and more that they had a social media intern for a couple of days who was doing weird stuff. But I definitely had a few moments of taking CIA from the best Twitter account in the US government to kind of the creepiest Twitter account in the US government. Like not 6 months ago, they had the CIA dogs. Did you guys see the CIA dogs? They're the puppies that they're training.
Yep.
They're beautiful.
I sure did.
They're great.
It was really well done.
Kind of less in favor of the propagandizing. But, you know, Twitter dogs, this is a nice transition over into pop culture. Which I confess I have not a lot going on in my pop culture world except for watching a lot of Octonauts, which neither of you would know what those are. It's a cartoon. Don't worry about it.
I was like, what?
What's going on in real pop culture land other than Avengers Infinity War, which, let's be realistic, neither of you have seen or know anything about.
No. I'm like really excited that we have Rebecca on because Rebecca is like my speed of pop culture. Rebecca is responsible for me reading these like Neapolitan novels, which if you are like me and you like, you know, good things objectively without anything else, you should definitely read the series of. But Rebecca, tell us of the pop cultures.
So I will attempt to make up for my horrible embarrassment in the movie quote department by making two pop culture recommendations. So one is I'm very excited for the premiere of the forthcoming TV series Sweet Bitter. It's based on a novel by Stephanie Dandler, which basically documents a young woman who comes to New York City and finds herself working in the restaurant industry. She's basically working at a thinly veiled version of Danny Meyer's Union Square Cafe. And it's a coming of age story. It's a very light read. It's a lot of fun, a lot about food and wine, but also romance. And so it's being made into a TV series, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
I agree. I, in fact, read that book on my several vacations ago on Rebecca's recommendation, and it was an excellent time because the following things ensue: a lot of drinking of complex wines, a lot of discussion of various food options, and some combination of hilarity and romance. And that's what I'm looking for out of pop culture, guys. That's what I'm looking for.
100%. It's a great vacation read. The second thing that I will recommend, I'm almost done with Tina Brown's memoir, which is basically an edited version, allegedly, of her diary from the 1980s. I'm kind of skeptical that anyone could be quite so elegant or prescient in their personal musings, but there it is. And that, I think, is fantastic for a few reasons. First, it's just a really fun portrait of the sort of freewheeling New York City in the 1980s, sort of before and after the stock market crash. Second, because of that, it has some pretty choice moments of encounter with our current president, Donald Trump, and sort of those in his scene at that time. And of course, many people have argued that, you know, to really understand the Trump psyche, you have to sort of understand New York in the 1980s. So it has a bit of currency from that perspective. But third, it's a really awesome portrait of a woman who's quite young for the job that she gets as editor of Vanity Fair and then later The New Yorker, who just comes in, she takes charge, she gets results, she negotiates serious raises, she has a baby, she tries to keep all the balls in the air, she's juggling them. And so I think also sort of in our current moment and just in general, it's a lot of fun to read about a woman who is, you know, not always perfect, but very much finding a way to have it all in her own way.
It's good because I one time many moons ago gave advice to a friend who was like chief of staffing in a different role when I was chief of staffing at DOD. And she, I told her that she needed to let bossiness into her heart. Like instead of just worrying about it, just like really just let it flow through your veins and really embrace it and go forth. And so I feel like this book is the balm to letting bossiness into your heart.
Totally. I kind of hate this whole girl boss, like hashtag girl boss thing, but Tina Brown is definitely one of those.
Rada, what is new in your pop culture world?
I don't have a lot new in my pop culture world. I will start watching the show Killing Eve, which I feel like will allow us a pop culture discussion here when Aaron returns. So Aaron,
so I can also add my endorsement to that one, Rada. You will like it.
It's really excellent.
Good. Yes.
Okay, good. But mostly I have been rereading
because I can't handle the stress of not knowing what's going to happen in books that I've read not read before, rereading this Jesse Klein, You'll Grow Out of It, which I can highly recommend it. I believe also was recommended to me by the way. Yeah. There you go.
Now we know why I got an invitation on the show.
Well, if you have free time in your pop cultural world, I would love to recommend to everyone the podcast Horns of a Dilemma, which is another podcast that from War on the Rocks, the latest episode with an interview with Angela Stent, a Georgetown University professor. This is a part of the partnership with War on the Rocks and the University of Texas. So if you are fans of either, I definitely recommend that everyone check it out. And with that, ladies, anything else?
I think we should call it.
All right. We'll catch you guys in a couple weeks.